Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. On edge, tensions remain high nationwide ahead of the presidential transfer of power amid threats of violence and consequences for the insurrection in Washington. Then, another grim milestone. The U.S. nears 400,000 deaths from COVID as the vaccination campaign continues to struggle. And words for the moment. The poet tapped to speak at the inauguration discusses her message during this fraught moment in America.
I began writing the poem, and then as I was around halfway through, we had the insurrection at the Capitol. Those events just solidified how important it was to have a poem about unity.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Inauguration Day is now 2 days away, and officials around the country are pulling out all the security stops. Just the same, worries kept Washington very much on edge today. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
For a moment, the drill became reality. This morning, soldiers and law enforcement practicing inauguration security suddenly sheltered for fear of attack. It turned out the threat was this nearby fire, which was quickly extinguished. But it shows the tension in Washington, D.C. ahead of Wednesday's inauguration. Thousands of National Guard soldiers continue to arrive. More than 25,000 will secure the city and surround the Capitol with rifles and bulletproof vests behind 7-foot-high fences. Downtown D.C. is on lockdown, a normally festive inauguration week replaced with barricades and security checks. The Washington Monument closed behind rings of security.
We're here to protect the citizens of the United States just as much as we are the seat of our government. So no one should fear us unless they have ill will in their heart.
Every guardsman takes an oath, and it's to defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. And as we've seen, sometimes the enemies are a little closer to home.
For the military, the fear is very close to home. The Associated Press found more than 20 Capitol Hill insurrectionists were current or former members of the U.S. military or of law enforcement. The FBI and National Guard are now vetting the guardsmen securing D.C. for ties to extremists. And the Guard is providing new training for how to spot anything, quote, not appropriate. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy spoke to the AP.
January 6th, there were representatives from all of the services who were at the rally when it started on the Ellipse and then migrated towards the Capitol. So the question is that all of them? Are there others? We're continually going through the process and taking second, third looks at every one of the individuals assigned to this operation.
But a senior defense official tells PBS NewsHour the military remains concerned because Guard leaders don't know their soldiers well. And while the FBI will check guardsmen's names in law enforcement databases, neither the FBI nor the military have the time to check all soldiers' social media. Outside of D.C. and state capitals, the threat remains high. National Guardsmen secured Pennsylvania's seat of government and guarded the base of the state capitol in Atlanta. That deterred most of yesterday's planned armed protests, except in Salt Lake City, where a small group did bring their guns to town. And another small armed group showed up in Lansing, Michigan, despite a weekend show of force.
You hope for the best, you prepare for the worst, and clearly we're prepared.
Meanwhile, newly released video from New Yorker magazine journalist Luke Mogelson shows how unprepared the Capitol was for the January 6th siege. Rioters told police they were following President Trump.
If we're outnumbered, there's a million of us out there, and we are listening to Trump. You're the boss.
We can't be disrespectful.
Don't disrespect.
They can steal an election, we can't sit in their chair.
No!
Inside the Senate chamber, insurrectionists argued with each other, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Larry Brock used a military term for information operations.
It's an Iowa war. We can't lose the Iowa war.
We're better than that.
Hey, man.
But others took the space less seriously and cited senators who questioned the election.
I think Cruz would want us to do this, so
yeah, absolutely.
I think we're good.
I just want to let you guys know, this is like the sacredest place.
A lone police officer, severely outnumbered, eventually got them to leave, but made no arrests, despite the obvious, ominous threat.
It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming.
All right, come on.
Overwhelmed 2 weeks ago when the military presence was non-existent, the city, military, and federal government now hope an unprecedented show of force keeps the Capitol secure.
And Nick joins me now. So, Nick, you've been talking to so many people today. Bottom line, how concerned is the military?
Yeah, Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller released a statement saying there was no specific threat, but as we reported, the military is very concerned, according to the senior officials I'm talking to, in part because, again, they're not checking these soldiers' social media, and because commanders don't really know these guardsmen that well. They just don't spend that much time with them. So to try and mitigate that, there has been additional training institute for the guards as they arrive into D.C. to try and train everyone to look out for insider threats. But Judy, we are talking about this as or even after guard have arrived in D.C. The independent analysts I talked to say it is simply too late in a comprehensive way to check whether there's any insider threats. In an ideal world, this would have been done a long time ago in a much more comprehensive way.
And Nick, those independent experts, analysts you've been talking to, how good a job do they say the military has done searching for extremists in their ranks?
Yeah, so what the military says, it tries its best and it maintains an awareness of these threats, including right-wing extremists, and that on the active duty side, commanders spend a lot of time with their soldiers, and so they can keep an eye on them. But the independent analysts point out that the military is not a domestic intelligence agency. There have been lots of problems in the past, and frankly, there were veterans and people connected to the military who took part in the siege. And so earlier today, I talked to Heidi Beirich. She's the co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She said the military is not doing well enough and that service members are targets.
Well, extremist groups are very keen on recruiting active duty soldiers and veterans into their ranks. They value the skills and the abilities that these people have learned while in the military. That goes for white supremacist groups, groups that perhaps want to engage in something like a race war. They want those skills in their ranks. And in the militia movement, the American militia movement, folks with a military background are probably the most prized members of the groups. You also have individuals who are involved in those groups before they join the military being encouraged by the extremist groups to get those skills.
So given those attempts, do you believe the military has taken the idea or the threat of extremists in its ranks seriously in the past?
Unfortunately, I don't. You know, in the military, there have been fits and starts in dealing with the issue of hate groups in particular, but the regulations always seem to come after the threat has shown itself. And one of the big issues we've had in recent years is that the military regulations are not up to the level where they need to be in a world in which people are radicalized online en masse, including troops, and in which extremist groups are recruiting from them. And, you know, folks in the military themselves know about this. The Military Times has done a series of polls that show between one-third and one-half of troops in the last 4 years have seen white nationalism in the ranks. So the military is not doing enough to root this problem out right now.
Beirich says that the military does a better job at kicking out gang members, Judy, than kicking out white supremacists.
So, Nick, what is it believed that the military could do to address these concerns?
Yeah, the answer to that is really fundamental, Judy, and it is the key question. And the experts say that it starts at the beginning. It needs to start with how the military recruits. But it also goes all the way to how the military defines the threat itself. So here again is Heidi Beirich.
There's quite a few things that could be done here. They need to tighten screening of recruits when they're coming into the military. Right now, the military doesn't even have a comprehensive tattoo database, which could show them when someone comes in from their tattoos that they've been involved in extremist groups. They need to monitor social media. They need to tighten the regulations to include a ban on involvement in paramilitary militia groups. That doesn't exist right now. And members of the different parts of the armed forces who worked in the investigative divisions didn't even among themselves agree on what they should be looking for. So there are a whole host of things that need to happen to fix this problem.
Byrick says the military can take this more seriously, Judy, and the Biden administration can actually take steps to make this a priority as well.
And finally, Nick, you've also been talking to folks in the intelligence community about how they see this threat. Tell us what they're saying.
Yeah, this is a particular problem for the intelligence community, which, of course, on normal basis cannot actually look into or target Americans. But it does know that it needs to help confront this challenge. And to discuss that earlier today, I had a conversation with Sue Gordon, the former principal deputy director of national intelligence from 2017 to 2019. And we talked about not only the insider threat, but also the state of the intelligence community at the end of the Trump administration. Sue Gordon, welcome back to the NewsHour. From where you've sat inside the intelligence community, how big of a threat is the so-called insider threat?
Great to see you, Nick. The insider threat is always the most daunting and the most difficult because you have people who are ostensibly trusted. They have access to information that helps them in their intention. And in general, we don't have as many systems as we might looking at our own people. So insider threats are particularly insidious, and when they are affected, can be incredibly damaging.
Do you think the U.S. government has done a good job when it comes to domestic extremism? And as you just suggested, does there need to be some kind of structural reform in order to deal with this kind of threat?
I think domestic extremism is a particularly challenging issue. Number one, from an intelligence perspective, remember, our intelligence community doesn't typically or statutorily look at U.S. citizens, so you don't have the advantage of that craft in the way you might for other threats. Two, just our Constitution and the rights of citizens. And then if law enforcement is the lead, law enforcement needs some sort of predicate. You have to have done something. And so if nothing is manifest, it's difficult. Do I think that we need a moment of considering how we're going to deal with this threat that looks like it's going to be with us for a while? Yeah, I think you almost need a 9/11 commission kind of activity. It's got to be a combination of FBI. It has to include DHS. And you've got to find a way to bring intelligence or the craft of intelligence into it. And I don't think that's in one organization right now. You know, as an old intelligence hand, there are elements of this that remind me of the rise of Islamic extremism and what it looks like. And there are probably a fair number of lessons that we learned in the fight against foreign terrorism that can be applied here, and some lessons that we probably don't want to apply. So you have to get some of the people that know about extremism, and we need to bring it to bear domestically, because this is just one of those issues that must be addressed, because it's not just a fly-by-night activity right now.
I want to expand out to the state of the intelligence community. In the last few days, Michael Ellis, a Trump loyalist and political aide, was installed into the career and crucial role as counsel general in the National Security Agency. And a U.S. official confirms to me that President Trump came very close to installing Kash Patel, another loyalist, into CIA as deputy director, and that would have led to Gina Haspel's resignation, making Kash Patel the acting director of CIA. What's the impact of those moves?
Yeah, so first think about what intelligence really is. It is a discipline that is, while it is responsible for assisting policy determination and assisting policy execution, it is independent from policy. And you get into trouble when you start trying to use intelligence either to be shaped by or to influence policy directly. And so given that backdrop, when you put in people who appear to be politically motivated, the risk you run is that they will pursue an action without the foundation of understanding what the impact is. And again, intelligence is a pretty arcane craft. You don't want to just declassify things because you want to tell a story. You have to understand the impact on sources and method. You have to understand what part of the story you're telling. And so what happens is if you put people who appear to be political into these kind of positions, the American people who have given a lot of authority to their intelligence apparatus can worry about whether they can be they can trust that those authorities will be protected. So that has nothing to do with Michael or nothing to do with Cash. That's a whole different issue. But when you start mixing politics with the craft of intelligence, you run the risk of politicizing this very independent discipline.
You raised the word declassification. Let me ask you about a specific declassification that administration officials admit to me is still being debated, even just 2 days before inauguration, and that is the declassification of material that could reveal sources and methods when it comes to Russia's interference in 2016, but President Trump believes would benefit him politically. What would be the impact if that material is declassified?
So it depends on what the material is. So you go through a pretty easy conversation to have. Number one, what I would say to the American people is the American people do actually have access to all the information of the intelligence community. We're a representative republic. The oversight committees have access to all the information we have. So it's not that it's being hidden. The question is, does it need to be made unclassified? The second is, what purpose is being served? Because there is always a cost of declassification. Sometimes it's really good. Election security. A lot was declassified to try and show that threat, but it has to be done purposefully. And then the last thing is, which pieces of intelligence are you going to declassify? What part of the story are you going to tell? Do they stand alone? Is it data that has credibility? And so you just can't do this casually. And it should never be done for other than the nation's purpose.
I've been told that the director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, has resisted that particular attempt to declassify. Has she been right to resist?
I've known Gina a long time. There is no more steely-eyed professional. She would absolutely feel her responsibility and execute it to the best of her abilities, both working to be responsive to the president. Because remember, the CIA has a very special relationship with presidents over history. And she would want to make sure that no matter what pressure she's under, she is using her knowledge of the costs and the benefit to be able to weigh that out. But the same answer I gave before is, it's not that information can't be shared with the president. He could receive any information. The question is there advantage in making piece parts in the raw available to the public? And my guess is that she's weighing it out, her responsibility and the interests of the president, and she's come down on this side.
And when it comes to intelligence, there's also the question of a former president getting it. You wrote this weekend in the Washington Post that after inauguration, President Trump should be blocked from receiving security briefings that other former presidents typically receive. This weekend, Biden's incoming chief of staff said that they would consider that. Why do you think it's necessary?
So I wrote it from the perspective of an intelligence assessment, just looking at the security profile of this president at this time with his stated intentions to potentially run for office, to do business overseas. And this isn't a time that you necessarily have to give him more access to classified information because there are those who would try and do him harm. And the neat part is, I think I'm seen as relatively nonpartisan even since departure, so I hope it had a weight to it. And the second is, all I was advocating was using the traditional standard of need to know. And my assertion is, I don't think this president needs to know at this time. If he does in the future, the administration can grant it then.
Sue Gordon, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.
Among fears of threats and plans to celebrate, we check in now with our White House correspondent, Yamiche Alcindor. So hello, Yamiche. I know you've been following the Biden transition team very closely. What more can you share with us about the concerns and plans to deal with any threats, any worries about security on Wednesday?
Well, the inauguration team of both President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris are projecting confidence in saying that this will be, they believe, a safely held event. They also believe that these two will be able to hit the ground running, specifically on the inauguration team and security. They say they've been working with their security partners for months and that they are confident that they are assessing the situation. This is really a key thing because they say, and officials that I talk to say, inaugurations have a long, long period where they are assessing security matters, and that is just going to be heightened in the aftermath of the siege on the Capitol. Another thing is Joe Biden, while he's preparing for inauguration security, he also has his mind on his inauguration speech. And I just talked to a Biden official who told me that he's going to be focused on the theme of unity. He's also going to be focused on talking about where we are now and where we are going to be going. And Vice President-elect Harris, she resigned formally from the Senate today, and she was questioned about this issue of security. She said that she felt like she was confident, and she said, "I look forward to taking the oath." She said that she was going to proudly have her head up and her shoulders back. So that is the Biden team's stance on security.
And Yamiche, we know you've been following both the president coming in and the president who's leaving. So tell us what more are you learning about what President-elect Biden plans for his first few days in office and what President Trump has in mind for his last day or two?
That's right. Well, President-elect Biden has an ambitious plan to get things started. And President Trump is also mulling a few things to try to leave his legacy on the White House and this country. The first thing is that in the first day that Joe Biden takes office, he's going to be doing a number of executive actions. His chief of staff, Ron Klain, listed them. So I want to walk through some of them. The first is that he's going to be issuing a mask mandate on federal property and interstate travel. He's also going to be extending a pause on federal student loan payments and interest. He plans to try to help, he says, the millions of Americans with federal student loans. He's also going to be rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. That's that agreement between the United Nations framework, and it deals with climate change. President Trump very famously pulled out of that. And he's also going to be planning to rescind the travel ban on Muslim-majority countries. That, again, was a signature President Trump ban, and it was something that critics call discriminatory. Joe Biden is also, in the days after that, going to be focused on COVID-19 in particular, trying to do actions related to the vaccine rollout, as well as testing. And President Trump, he's, I'm told, looking at pardons, really angry and frustrated and still not having any public events. But from my understanding, they are gearing up for some sort of long list of pardons, as well as the president also possibly having a big send-off on the morning of inauguration, because as we've reported, he will not be going to the inauguration.
That's right, in a precedent-breaking move. Yamiche Alcindor reporting, as we said, on both the incoming and the outgoing president. Thank you, Yamiche. In the day's other news, the United States neared 400,000 deaths from COVID-19, with numbers rising in nearly two-thirds of the states. In all, the country has recorded more than 24 million confirmed cases. That's out of 95 million worldwide. As the winter surge continues, the head of the World Health Organization warned today that rich nations are buying up vaccines, leaving poor nations wanting.
Ultimately, these actions will only prolong the pandemic, prolong our pain. The restrictions needed to contain it, and human and economic suffering.
We'll return to the pandemic after the news summary. President-elect Biden has named his choices to lead two major regulatory bodies. He will nominate Rohit Chopra for director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Chopra is a progressive ally of Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. And Gary Gensler is tapped to chair the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's now at MIT after years spent on Wall Street and chairing the Commodity Futures Trading Commission under President Obama. The president-elect also joined in a national day of service honoring the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Mr. Biden and family members spent part of the day in Philadelphia. They filled boxes with canned goods at a hunger relief organization. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris volunteered at a food bank in Washington, D.C. In Russia, opposition leader Alexei Navalny will spend 30 days in jail after a court hearing in Moscow today. He was arrested Sunday as he returned to Russia for the first time since being poisoned with a Soviet-era nerve agent. Jonathan Rugman of Independent Television News has our report.
Alexei Navalny broadcast the drama to his millions of social media followers. He was sentenced to 30 days jail before another hearing about supposedly violating his probation.
The criminal procedure code has been blatantly torn up and thrown into the garbage. This is the highest degree of lawlessness.
It was last August that Mr. Navalny was taken ill on a plane, with labs in three countries later concluding he'd been attacked with nerve agent. He and his wife, Yulia, knew he would be arrested upon his return last night. Yet he also knew he had no credibility in exile and could pose no real threat to President Putin from foreign soil. Though he has helped identify the Russian secret servicemen accused by investigative journalists of trying to kill him.
Konstantin.
Speaking to one of them who confessed to the poisoned underwear plot. News broadcasters ignored today's hearing, apart from this daytime crime show, which announced that Navalny had it coming, and that his fleet of cars in Berlin showed he was being bankrolled by Western spies. Navalny himself wants more sanctions on Moscow, as he told the European Parliament in November.
European Union should target the money, and Russian oligarchs, not just old oligarchs, but also new ones, like this circle of Mr. Putin.
Tonight, Navalny told his supporters that they should take to the streets, with protests planned for Saturday.
That report from Jonathan Rugman of Independent Television News. Extreme cold and snow blanketed much of Europe today. Temperatures in parts of Poland dropped to 18 degrees below zero, the lowest in 11 years. In Warsaw, the deep freeze cracked railroad tracks. Far to the south, in Turkey, cars and buses in Istanbul skidded on icy roads, forcing traffic to a standstill. Hundreds of migrants bound for the U.S. are at a standstill in southeastern Guatemala. They've been stopped near the village of Vado Hondo. Part of some 8,000 people who crossed from Honduras. On Sunday, security forces beat back the migrants with sticks and tear gas. Some were forced back into Honduras, while others were bused back voluntarily. And back in this country, the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund announced a $40 million scholarship program on this King Day to educate new civil rights lawyers. A single anonymous donor gave the group the money. The selected students must commit to 8 years of racial justice work across the South. Still to come on the NewsHour, the U.S. approaches another grim milestone in the ongoing pandemic. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter on the end of the Trump era and the start of the Biden presidency. And the National Youth Poet Laureate discusses her message at the inauguration.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As part of Inauguration Week, there will be tributes on the National Mall to remember the 400,000 people in this country who've died from COVID-19. It was just about a year ago when the first confirmed cases of this novel coronavirus were found in the U.S. But the scope of the problem has accelerated dramatically this fall and winter, with the last 100,000 deaths occurring just in the last month or so. William Brangham looks at where we are and the ongoing efforts to get vaccines into the arms of Americans.
Judy, as you said, just the numbers over the last several weeks have been staggering.
Each day, the nation is averaging about 130,000 hospitalizations and more than 3,000 deaths. That's every single day. States reported more than 23,000 deaths over the past week alone. That's 25% higher than any other week since the pandemic began, according to the COVID Tracking Project. In fact, the project reported that last week's total number of deaths exceeded the CDC's estimate of total flu-related deaths from last year. Of course, vaccination remains a key hope for eventually finding our way out of this pandemic, but distribution remains slow and confusing and disorganized in many places. Colorado's Democratic Governor Jared Polis is one of several governors who've been publicly critical of the Trump administration's work on that front, and he joins me now. Governor Polis, great to have you back on the NewsHour. Before we get to policy questions, I wonder if you could just reflect on this year that we have been through. You only had a year in the governor's office before the pandemic hit. We've now lost 400,000 Americans. I know you've lost, I think it's 5,000 Coloradans. Can you just give us a sense of what this year has been like for you and for your state?
Well, first, you know, condolences to all those who lost a loved one. I mean, first and foremost, that 400,000 number is seared into the collective soul of America, an unprecedented level of loss. Beyond that, it's loss of our elderly relatives' ability to socialize and see one another, even those who weren't affected by the health crisis, to see, you know, senior homes where there's no poker night, there's no movie night in the golden years of their life, to see kids who have only been able to go to school sporadically, small business owners who've risking everything they have, some are losing their businesses. So first and foremost, the human toll, the loss, the death. Beyond that, the economic toll and the psychological and social toll of this pandemic.
So let's talk about this issue with regard to vaccine distribution. Last week, the HHS Secretary Alex Azar said that the federal government was going to release all of its reserve doses. These were the doses they had held back, the second shots. And then later in the week, you were told that that actually wasn't going to happen, that the reserve wasn't really there. You referred to this as gross incompetence. You said you'd been lied to. Could help us understand what actually happened.
Well, so yes, you know, based on the announcement from Secretary Azar, a call with the White House, including Vice President Pence and others, we had expected that there would be a second dose that had been held back that would be given to the states expeditiously, immediately, presumably this week. Doing the math, that would have come out to about 200,000 plus for Colorado. I was just shocked during a couple of days later. It was revealed that, in fact, that was false. There was no national stockpile. I mean, however, whatever level of distrust or dislike I might have for the current president, I really thought that the people that were running this would be straightforward with information. So I don't know why we were led to believe that. As I said, incompetence is the most likely excuse. I don't think it was deliberate sabotage. I would also add that there's still some question, and I can't. When you look at the statements at Pfizer put out, it seems like some of these reserve doses might in fact exist, not in government custody, but in fact in the custody of Pfizer itself. So I can't wait till the new administration gets to the bottom of this and gets all available dosage out so we can put it in, help start protecting people.
So I know that your goal is to vaccinate 70% of 70-year-olds in your state by the end of February. Does this hiccup affect those plans in any way?
No, we'll get that done. We were hoping that it would be accelerated significantly. We have about 530,000 people over the age of 70. If we had a week with 200,000 plus vaccines available, we would get upwards of half of the 70 and up, and we could move on to people 65 and up, teachers and others even sooner. The conservative date, that a goal that we have by the end of February, 70%, is based on our current modeling of supply. Any additional supply we get could accelerate that. And I'm really hopeful that we will find that the next administration will find additional supply, perhaps at Pfizer, at Moderna, get it shipped out and get it into people's arms to protect them.
I know that in Colorado you had a very bad fall, November in particular, but currently your numbers seem to be moving in all the right directions, the hospitalizations, the deaths, the case levels. I know you've extended your mask mandate statewide now for the ninth time. Do you have a sense as to why you're doing well right now? Why is that?
Well, Coloradans are doing the right thing. That means wearing the mask around others. It means avoiding socializing with people outside of their home and trying to keep a distance where they can. How well the virus spreads is simply a function of human behavior. We've done our best to help educate Coloradans about what they can do to protect themselves and their family. And when people make the right decisions collectively as a people, it can move us in the right direction.
Can we shift gears now? I want to ask you a bit about the inauguration. Given what we saw happening here in Washington on January 6th, I know the FBI sent a memo out to all the governors saying that you all should be on the lookout for armed protests at your own state capitals. Is that something that you're worried about, and what kind of precautions are you all taking?
Well, I was proud yesterday morning to go to Buckley Air Force Base, where Colorado, we sent off 220 of our members of our National Guard to help protect our nation's capital and ensure a peaceful transition of power. It's our honor to do that as a state. I know other over 40 states have done so as well. We are also, of course, coordinating the protection of our own state capital, working with the Denver Police Department, Aurora Police Department, state troopers, and others to try to make sure that while, of course, people are always welcome to express their free speech, that we're able to protect the institution of our republic here in the state as well as in Washington, D.C.
I mean, I know there was supposed to be a protest yesterday in Denver, and I guess it turned out that more press showed up than protesters. Is it your sense that Wednesday is a real concern, or do you think that the aftermath of January 6th has made a lot of these groups at least dial back their plans for big armed protests?
I think that the precautions that both the federal government and states are taking absolutely are really sending a message that people will be held accountable for their actions. The fact that the FBI has been actively investigating the failed insurrection and takeover of the United States Capitol, a number of arrests have been made. I am confident that now that people know that we in the states, the federal government, is taking this very seriously, that can serve as a major deterrent to this kind of lawlessness and aggressive behavior.
And lastly, Governor, you're the governor of a purple state. I wonder what your sense is of how we go forward as a nation when so many people have been convinced that this election and this inauguration is a fraud, that they've been fed this lie that somehow this is an invalid election that's been stolen. How do you counsel us generally to go forward with that?
We really do need to come together as a country. Look, I'm a Democrat. I wasn't thrilled when Donald Trump was elected. Hillary Clinton got more votes, but Donald Trump won by the rules. He won the Electoral College. He became president. I was a member of Congress. I proudly attended his inauguration and was part of witnessing the peaceful transition of power. We don't win. Nobody in this country wins every election. Elections don't turn out the way that everybody wants by the nature of a democracy. But it's a far better system than the alternative. The alternative ignoring the voice of the people. And I think that by and large, most Americans, Republican, Democrat, Independent, really understand that. And I think it's time for us to redouble our dedication to our republic and to our Constitution.
All right, Governor Jared Polis of Colorado, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Just days after the second impeachment of outgoing President Trump, and days before the inauguration of incoming President Biden, it's time for our regular Politics Monday duo. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and Tamara Keith of NPR. It's so good to see both of you, and this is the last time the three of us will be gathering on a Monday during the Trump presidency. So, Tam, let's start by talking about that. So much has happened in the last days of President Trump's time in office, but when you think about his legacy, what are you thinking at this point?
You know, every time we think we know what his legacy will be, more things happen. And, you know, in the end, his presidency ended with him denying the result of the election, leading his supporters into believing something that caused an insurrection. And he also did oversee the loss of the House and the Senate for Republicans. And he was impeached a second time. So in the end, there's a lot of stuff on that last couple of months resume that tarnishes what many of his supporters say were good things, like passing the tax cuts or building the wall. I mean, you talk to supporters of the president and they still love what he did for on policy. That's what they'll say again and again. But in terms of the overall picture, gosh, there's a lot to tarnish what his supporters like.
Yes, there is, and people will point to his foreign policy and say there are aspects of that that they like. But you're right, so much of that getting overshadowed right now. Amy, you've taken a look, among much else, at the public opinion polls here at the very end. What are the American people saying when they look at President Trump?
Right, Judy, we've had a lot of polls that have come out this week. You know, this is the sort of typical time when the final moments of a presidency to sort of check in, as you said, about how people feeling about the outgoing president and then the incoming one. And these, of course, were all taken since the events at the Capitol on January 6th. What we find is there's been a drop in the president's overall approval rating, on average about 6 points across all of these different polls. You have some polls that show the president at historically low ratings. Pew had him at 29% job approval rating. Others, like the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, that show him basically where he's been for most of his presidency, right around 43%. But what is notable, Judy, is that in almost every single one of these polls, 75% to 80%+ of Republicans continue to give the president high marks, think that he's done a good job, is currently doing a good job as president. And that matters because of its impact on the people that are sitting in Congress right now. There's not a political incentive for Republicans to distance themselves from the president. And as Tam pointed out, this is a legacy that certainly not only is it right now not looking very good, he has one of the lowest overall approval ratings in Gallup history leaving office, but it also means that he's going to have a legacy, I think, that's going to continue to evolve even in these next few months. I mean, every president, right, over time sees his legacy change and evolve. But in this case, just in the next few months, as we have these impeachment hearings, as we have hearings run by a Democratic-controlled Congress, opinions of this president could look very different at the end of the year, even than they do right now.
And as we see how his loyal followers are prepared to work or not with with President Biden. And Tam, you've done a lot of reporting on what we should expect from Joe Biden, the president-elect, once he takes office. What are you hearing about? What should we expect in the way of messages from him, both in his inaugural speech and in what he does in the first few days in office?
Right. As Yamiche was saying, unity is expected to be a theme. Of course, that is something that Biden ran on, the idea of restoring the soul of America and unifying the country. It's a tall order. I spent a lot of time talking to historians and one former speechwriter over the past few days. And this is a unique moment, uniquely challenging. And none of them thought that a single speech could really change much. But in terms of precedent, I mean, FDR had the Great Depression, but he didn't also have a pandemic, though they say that there is a model there in sort of leveling with the American people. And the other example that they thought of was potentially Richard Nixon, which is ironic because his legacy is not one of unity, to say the least. But he came in at a time of great social and racial division in the country. In essence, Biden doesn't have a guidebook to follow here. There isn't a playbook for this. It's going to be a challenge. And then he will come in and do a lot of executive actions, as presidents have come to do, reversing as much of what his predecessor did as he possibly can.
And Amy, I mean, all we can think about at this point are the challenges facing Joe Biden. Is it pretty much an uphill situation that he's facing as he steps into the White House? Is it all uphill? He gets up every morning and thinks about, you know, the tough moves he has to make, the tough decisions he has to make. I want to ask you that, but I also am curious, how receptive do you think the American people are? How open are they to see what he does?
Well, that's what I was going to say, Judy, is it's one thing to come into office with all these challenges in front of you. It's another thing to come in at a time where we're as polarized as we are. You know, you look back even not that far back to 2009, when Barack Obama was coming into office with the financial crisis, but he had a really deep well of goodwill, overwhelmingly positive, favorable ratings. Right now, it looks, at least in the most recent polling, that while people feel generally good about Biden, it's not off the charts good, it's fine, right? And as I said, Republicans overwhelmingly not only supportive of the president, the current president, but not feeling very good about the incoming one. But the most important thing, Judy, I think, is how important it will be for Joe Biden to preach unity is, of course, coming through in his speech. But it will be effective if he is able to make government effective. Making this vaccine rollout work is going to do more, I think, to unify the country, or at least to minimize our partisanship and our polarization, than any speech could ever do. Because part of the challenge we're in right now as a country is the loss of faith in our institutions, government being one of them. Government failing to do the things it should be able to do is what has gotten people to lose faith and to believe in many of the conspiracy theories out there. So I think that would go a long way, not just in helping the country, but in also in helping the opinions that Americans have about their institutions.
We will see. We'll be talking about it next Monday and for Mondays beyond, but this is the last time we'll see you both during the Trump administration. Thank you both. Amy Walter, Tamara Keith, thank you. And now to a young voice poised to speak to the nation. The poet who will present a new work at the inauguration this week is quite accomplished, yet only 22. She sounds many of Martin Luther King's themes and follows in the footsteps of poets including Robert Frost, Maya Angelou, Elizabeth Alexander, and Richard Blanco. Jeffrey Brown talked to Amanda Gorman as part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
While we might feel small, separate, and all alone, our people have never been more closely tethered, because the question isn't if we can weather this unknown, but how we will weather this unknown together.
In her poetry, Amanda Gorman explores topics such as race and marginalization, and often American history, as in a reading at the Library of Congress.
There's a poem in this place, a poem in America, a poet in every American who rewrites this nation, who tells a story worthy of being told on this minnow of an earth.
She was named the nation's first youth poet laureate at age 19. Now she's part of history on a monumental stage. How did she feel when the invitation came?
A lot of screaming. A lot of dancing around my apartment, but after that, I mean, it's such a huge honor to be able to participate in such a historic moment.
She spoke to us Friday from her Los Angeles home, where she continues to work on her inaugural poem titled The Hill We Climb. I asked what she most wanted to convey in these divisive times.
I began writing the poem in early January, I want to say, and then as I was around halfway through, we had the insurrection at the Capitol. And I don't want to say that my poem took a drastic left turn, because it was already going towards a location, but those events just solidified for me how important it was to have a poem about unity and, you know, the new chapter of America in this inauguration.
Who are you reading to? Who are you speaking to?
That's kind of the challenging thing about writing an inaugural poem. It's, you're speaking to everyone, but you don't also want to speak for everyone. So for me, it's trying to make a poem that is both robust, but also accessible to anyone who might be watching, that they can feel that they are represented and well-established in this poem. So it's a really difficult dance to do.
Gorman grew up in L.A., raised by her mother, a teacher, and with two siblings, including a twin sister. She had a speech impediment as a child and not only overcame it to perform as a poet, but at 16 started her own youth literacy program, One Pen, One Page, to help and encourage others.
One of the most rewarding moments of my career is when I'm speaking to a child who tells me they have, you know, the same speech impediment that I had to overcome and that they're going to keep writing or sharing their voice after hearing my story. So it's a huge aspect of who I am. Writing wasn't just a form of expression, it was a form of pathology. By, you know, embarking on spoken word over and over and over again and reciting my poems, no matter how terrified I was, because I had the support of others, I was able kind of to slowly climb my way to the place I am at today.
It's something, it turns out, you share with the president-elect, with Joe Biden.
It's also something I not only share with the president-elect, but with a previous inaugural poet, Maya Angelou, who also, you know, was mute growing up. So there's a lot of historicity in overcoming that.
What is the power of poetry for you?
Ooh, the power of poetry is everything for me. Poetry is, it's an art form, but to me it's also a weapon, it's also an instrument. It's the ability to make ideas that have been known, felt, and said. And that's a real, I think, type of duty for the poet. One of my favorite writers, Audre Lorde, has said there's no new ideas, just new ways of making them felt. And that's what I try to do.
She's written for a July 4th celebration featuring the Boston Pops Orchestra.
Today, we gather so a founder's words do not go diminished.
A tribute to Black athletes for Nike, an inauguration at Harvard, from which she's a recent graduate. A children's book, Change Sings, and a poetry collection will be released this year. And she has some high political aspirations of her own.
I saw in an interview where you said that you yourself wanted to be president at one point. You even pinpointed the year, I think, huh?
2036, because that will be the election year in which I'll be old enough to run, so.
You're getting close now at this point.
I feel like I should just, like, tap Joe at the inauguration and be like, I'll be back, you know. Let me know how this goes for when I come along. But honestly, it began, I remember being really young, and as I am today, very passionate about social issues. And a teacher said to me, kind of maybe half jokingly, well, you should become president. And I was like, that is not a joke. Let's do it. So definitely doing it. Hashtag Commander-in-Chief.
For now, though, she's focused on her poetry.
Let each dawn find us courageous, brought closer, heeding the lights before the fight is over. When this ends, we'll smile sweetly, finally seeing, in testing times, we became the best of beings.
Look forward to hearing her poem on Wednesday. And before we go, we want to take a moment to look at an art display lit just this evening on the National Mall to celebrate the inauguration and to call for unity. It's called Field of Flags. It shows 56 pillars of light representing all our states and territories. It's meant to welcome our 46th president at a moment when so many of us will be reflecting on where we are as a country and where we are headed. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.